Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 239, a conversation with Dr. Mark Hyman.
Hello, everybody. We are here on the Bob Thurman podcast, and which I think I might rename Buddhas Have More Fun Podcast.
I like that.
I might, but depending on whether my publisher lets me keep that working title or not. I know it's a hard title at the moment. We're all suffering the COVID virus freakout, but that's what I might call it. At the moment, it's the Bob Thurman podcast. And I am so honored and pleased and delighted to have Dr. Mark Hyman here with me, who I'm a complete fan of his work. And I've known him for some time, but we're also busy, you know, in life. And we don't get to see our good friends we have natural affinities with so often. But when I read his, and I've used even his books, The Metabolic and this and that, and Where's Mark Hyman? And all this. So Dr. Mark Hyman is a practicing family physician. That also freaked me out. All the physicians are some sort of specialist, and you're a family physician. Our medical system, we have to bring from Pakistan or India or Thailand some family practitioner. And yet you are that. That's what the major thing is, to take care of families. I think it's just great. What I am so excited about, although now that I've rediscovered Mark more in detail, there's many more things I'm excited about, but I am so totally excited about his food fix. Because doctors, you know, normally they deal with their patients. And they try to do the best they can. And then sometimes some patient has in family abuse, et cetera. They'll maybe try to help them in their setting, you know, in the household. In the household, they will, you know, if it's some sort of, if that connects to their symptoms and the cause of their thing. And the functional people are particularly good in going deep causation. But if you go to deeper causation, it's the whole food system. It's the whole agricultural, the business system, the whole culture, materialist culture actually is making so many people sick with all these chronic illnesses. And this book totally gets it. And I just can't believe that because, you know, I'm retired, as you all know, I think, from previous podcasts. I'm retired. I'm an emeritus professor at my dear old Columbia. And I've become a climate reality project leader, supposedly, and I do my best, you know, to do that, give talks and things, and I'm really into Greta Thunberg, and I'm a great-grandfather, I have a great-grandchild, and I don't want to turn the planet over in this mess to those people. So I'm so thrilled to have Mark, Dr. Mark, here on the thing, and so I have some questions for you. Mark, so nice to have you here, really.
Oh, it's so great to be here with you, Professor.
Good. So anyway, how did you get into food fix? How did you do it? I have had many MD acquaintances who do good work the best they can, but when I bugged them, which I did before I was doing climate reality, I did that as a professor, that tracking the source of diseases they have to deal with back into the soil of the earth. Cancer is in the soil. Cancer is in the Monsanto chemicals. Cancer is in the messing with the GMO, you know, HMO, you know, the politics of the country, etc., is beyond their scope, they say. Well, of course, they're all very stressed out, dealing with so many sick people. There's not enough doctors. We only have 2.4 per, 1,000. And in South Korea, they have 8 per thousand. Mm-hmm. And Cuba, they have 8. South Korea, they have 6 or something. You know? And but anyway, we have other good things, but we need more, and et cetera. Anyway, so they will give this kind of weight to the food system as part of the disease causes, mm-hmm. as you do. So your book, and agriculture, farming system. So your book really opened my eyes, and I hope it opens everyone's eyes. So are you concerned? So that's my first question.
Yeah.
So how did you get into this?
How did I get into this? Well, yeah. You have some small part of that. I think, for those of you listening, don't know much about me, I went to college and studied Buddhism after I heard Professor Thurman give a talk at Amherst in 1975. And it sort of set me on this path of understanding the nature of reality. And
1975?
Yes, that was the day.
My 1975.
And I was 15 years old, and it blew my mind. And it led me on the path of inquiry about the nature of reality, the nature of the cause of things and how things work, and the interconnectedness of things, and how we are all one system. And it sort of reminds me of that joke that I think it was an Italian news reporter had the Dalai Lama on an interview, and he said, he was trying to joke with the Dalai Lama. He didn't quite get it. He's like, "So what is the Dalai Lama's favorite pizza?" And it was one with everything. And the Dalai Lama was like, "One with everything? I don't know what you mean." But I think, and I think the idea that everything is connected has been a central frame of how I've seen the world from very early on. And I read a book way before I even thought about medicine. I was studying Buddhism. I studied biological agriculture at the Goddard College. That was the Institute for Social Ecology with Murray Bookchin, who was an anarchist at the time, a crazy guy. I was studying, all these different things. And this book I read called Soil and Health. And Sir Albert Howard was the father of organic agriculture. And he said, the whole problem of health in soil, plant, animal, and human is one great subject. So you can't tease these apart. They're one interconnected subject. And so as a doctor, I've been sitting in my office for 30 years seeing patients with chronic illness and diabetes and heart disease and Alzheimer's and cancer and autoimmune diseases and allergic diseases and digestive problems and all these issues.
Yes.
And when it's really through the lens of functional medicine, which is a systems view of disease, it's about a root cause analysis of the cause of disease and also the ways in which we can create health. It's really very akin to Buddhism. I began to ask the question, well, why are my patients sick? And it turned out most of them, to some degree or another, and often most of the reason was food. And it was really bad food. It was the processed industrial diet that we're eating, which we now know kills conservatively 11 million people a year. I think far more than that, actually.
Oh.
This is a global burden of disease study that was published a few years ago showing in 195 countries, and they looked at diets, lack of protective foods, which is whole real food, and too much of these ultra-processed foods kills 11 million people a year, which is more than anything else on the planet. More than smoking, more than accidents, more whatever. It's the number one cause of death and disease and suffering. And so I began to say, well, if the food is causing my patients to be sick, what's causing the food? So I began to go down that rabbit hole. Well, it's the food system. And then I'm like, well, what's causing the food system? Well, it's our food policies. And then what's causing the food policies? It's the food industry's influence on our government and controlling those policies that don't serve public health, but actually serve private profit. And so I began to really think, as a doctor, I cannot treat my patients in my office. I can't cure diabetes in my office. I can't cure heart disease in my office. It's cured on the farm, at the seed level, at the farm, in the soil. It's cured in the grocery store, in the kitchen, in the restaurants. That's where it's cured. And, the silver lining, we're now in the midst of this COVID pandemic, is that nobody's eating at fast food restaurants anymore.
Yes.
And that people are having to actually cook at home and reclaim their kitchens.
Yes.
And I hope they do it in a way that actually makes them healthy. And so I began to really think about going down this rabbit hole and exploring the interconnections. And I realized that everything's connected to our food system, and
yes,
some more than others, but most of our global problems and crises are connected to the way we grow food.
Yes.
How we process it, how we market it, distribute it, sell it, eat it, waste it. All these are one problem. And when you look at what they do, one, it causes the majority of death and disease on the planet. There's about 70 million people that die every year around the world, and probably 50 million of those deaths are contributed to our food system. It drives the economic problems resulting.
Yes.
From. So we're talking about the economic slowdown here from COVID, but the burden over the long haul on economies and governments from chronic disease is staggering. Right. Take this one fact: 1 out of 2 federal dollars, which is from our tax revenue, by 2025, which is very shortly to come, is going to be needed to pay for Medicare. And most of that, 80%+ of that, is for chronic disease that's preventable or treatable with food.
Yes.
So a staggering amount of money.
I know.
And then you've got the other consequences to social issues. For example, children.
Yes.
You know, children are unable to learn and focus and do well in school. There's a whole concept called the achievement gap, where kids eating junk food can't focus and learn, and they have behavior issues and violence and all sorts of problems. So we're threatening our future generation.
Yes.
Then it affects these poor communities that are targeted more. So they end up in this vicious cycle of food injustice, with food swamps and food deserts and lack of access. And the most vulnerable among us, the most underserved among us, are the most obese and the most sick and the most likely to die from chronic disease. It's like the third world. The life expectancy can be 20 years difference between a zip code with low socioeconomic status versus a more affluent zip code. That's right here in America. And so you've got that. And then you've got the consequences on mental health. We know there's just massive anxiety, depression, and mental health issues. And it turns out there's a whole field of nutritional psychiatry looking at the link between what we eat and our mood and our
behavior.
Oh, absolutely.
So there are people in the psychiatry onto that. Oh, that's great.
Yes, there is now an increasing awareness that food plays a role in mental health, and we often misconstrue emotional disturbances that are really resulting from physical causes. So there are real emotional things that happen to us, but there are also physical causes of mental health.
Absolutely.
And in prisons, they have violent crime go down by over 50% simply by swapping out healthy food for the junk food in prisons. And we think, wow, violent criminals, maybe some of their behavior is caused by what they're eating.
Of course.
So you've got all these issues. And then the bigger issues are the environment and climate issues. So so I think most of us are not aware that our food system, end to end, right, from the soil to deforestation to the food waste, to transport, refrigeration, processing, factory farming of animals, as a whole, end to end, is responsible for the number one cause of climate change.
Yes.
30 to 40% of all the carbon in the atmosphere today, which is a trillion tons, is from the destruction of our soil and soil erosion. And why? Because in the soil, in really rich soil, is carbon. And how did that happen? Well, the plants breathe carbon. They breathe carbon dioxide, which produce then something called carbohydrates, because it's carbon. Yes. Carbohydrates that go into the soil
and
the plant roots and enrich the soil and provide the food for the microbes. And it's this beautiful ecological cycle. When we till the soil and use chemicals in the soil, we literally kill the soil. It's like antibiotics for our gut microbiome. And that leads to the destruction of soil, which is driving up to 30 to 40% of the carbon in the environment. So it's also a carbon sink and it can solve it. And then you've got the environmental consequences around the pesticides, herbicides, fertilizers. I could go on and on. So you've got this entire ecosystem that's all connected, from the destruction of species and biodiversity and pollinators, to the destruction of humans, to the threats to our kids, to the threats to our social fabric. So you've got one problem that's seen as all these siloed issues. And I felt like I needed to tell the story of how this is all connected and expand the framework of my patient from being the person sitting in front of me to being the entire ecosystem of our system and everything that's connected. So that's the sort of short story.
That is awesome, really. Makes me think of a slogan, like a Thich Nhat Hanh type of slogan, that is your slogan.
Oh, what is it?
Peace is every bite.
Yes, peace is every bite. Yes, it's true.
Remember? Peace is every step. Peace is every, his is peace is every step. Peace is every bite.
Yeah, I mean, the fork is the most powerful thing to change the world if we all focused on that. You know?
Really
pitchfork and the actual fork.
Yes. Well, I'm so thrilled about it. It is totally, you know, in Tibetan medicine, I don't know if you ever actually looked at its text at all. I know you know about Medicine Buddha, but the first two ways you diagnose a patient's condition are lifestyle and food and diet. Before you talk about anything else, lifestyle and diet, those are the first two in analyzing causation. The second noble truth of a doctor, you know?
Yes.
Is the causation. And so
I'll send you an article that I wrote called The Right Medicine. Right, like it's like an additional to the Eightfold Path. It's called The Right Medicine.
And I talk about
Tibetan medicine, and I talk about how this is exactly the framework we need. What is the right medicine for what we have now? Well, the right treatment for the right person in the right time, and the right medicine is for our chronic disease epidemic. Is not just more pills and surgery. It's actually fixing the system that's causing the disease.
Of course, of course. And, you know, you never, even dear brave Bernie and Elizabeth, they're going to fix the financing and insurance and the whole thing, but you never hear them saying cost of it has to do with this big monster elephant in this room.
Yes.
Big ag and big food, you know.
Yes.
Just so brave of you. But now, so that's really wonderful. I'm so pleased. And what about how many other fellow colleague doctors have you enlisted on this? I mean, are you the lone? Are you out? I have not seen. I mean, are there other food fix style level books?
Nothing like this has ever been written, I think. No one's connected dots. I think there are some doctors.
I've never seen anything.
No, there's a doctor, Zach Bush, who is connecting the dots between soil and health and agriculture and so forth. And there's a doctor, Daphne Miller, who also has written a book called Pharmacology about the soil and our health.
Yes.
So there are people who are working on aspects of this,
yes.
But not the whole spectrum of all the interconnectivity here. And I think that's what we have to do.
Yes,
really
you're also activist. You've gone into the political thing, you know?
Yeah.
you live in Elizabeth Warren's state.
I do.
When she lists the corruption, does she mention big ag and big food? I don't think so. I
not really. You know, it's interesting. When you look at the amount of money and the lobbyists, you know, it's staggering.
I know.
The you know, if you look at a graph, you know, agriculture and big food is here and everything else is down here in terms of the amount of dollars. It just dwarfs the amount of money of every other industry, including fossil fuels.
Really? Including fossil fuels?
Including fossil fuels. It's double or triple. Just for food stamps, it's about $735 billion for one bill.
Okay, but out of that, going to the diabetes.
Out of the food stamp or SNAP program, 75% of it is for junk food. The 10% of soda is $7 billion a year, or 30 billion servings a year to the poor, making Coca-Cola the number one welfare recipient in America.
That's like, you know, 30 times what the fossil fuel is getting.
Yes.
So that's a huge.
It's a huge amount of money.
And then
there's agricultural subsidies that are about $44 billion over a period of 10 years. But just the last year, because of the incredible harm that was done to the Midwestern farms, where we lost 1 million acres that were flooded in part because of the effects of climate change, President Trump had to fork up a $20 billion relief bill because of that, and also the tariffs and the trade thing.
Know,
so that's like literally five times the annual subsidy to the entire agriculture industry in 1 year because of what was going on.
Well, yeah, that's a subsidy direct, but the SNAP subsidy, if that's $700 billion, that's $600 billion
they're subsidizing to junk food. $25 billion for school lunches.
Yeah.
Most of which is also junk food.
Pizza is a vegetable. Yes.
Yes. 25 billion. I read that. Yeah. That's when you look at it on an annual basis, just school lunches and SNAP is $100 billion a year.
Yeah, I think even more. Because they're buying, that means they have to buy that with the SNAP, so it goes right back to the company. But then this is the point I want to get to with this, as I do with the fossil fuel. And that I didn't even get, I read the book, but I didn't quite get the enormity of that. You realize that those people, what do they spend to lobby? Maybe $4 or $5 billion?
One bill, the farm bill, was $500 million. And that's a big bill. On a much smaller bill, which was euphemistically called the Denying Americans the Right to Know, or the DARK Act, which was a GMO labeling law, which was defeated in Congress, which is why we don't have transparency on GMO labels like most other countries, including Russia and China, which are not known for their democratic principles. They have GMO labeling. The food industry spent $192 million in 1 year to fight this one bill.
Right. But wait, but see, this is the point I want to make that I'd like to get to, that when in the activist side, if they are making several hundred billion, let's just say $300 billion out of the subsidies in the farm bill and this bill and that bill, and then the agricultural grow this crop and that bill and all of that, several hundred billion. And if they spend $20 billion, let's say, for all their lobbying, all their K Street offices, all the salaries.
No.
That, if I was a corrupt politician and I'm only getting $250,000 for my campaign, I'm like, what? I'm totally undercharging those bastards.
Yes, yes.
They should be giving...
It's not so transactional. I mean, I think that... Yes, they do support the campaigns of these politicians, and they are in their offices talking to them and, quote, educating them, right? Educating them. But what really has become clear to me is that there's nobody educating these lawmakers from the other side. And so I've had the opportunity to be in Washington and to meet with Republicans and Democrats and staffers, and the level of awareness of this is so low. Yes. And they're filled with all sorts of misinformation. So a typical lobby company, what they call advocacy group, from an industry will come into the White House or come into a senator or congressman's office, and they'll have a briefing book with 50 regulations they want modified, with legislation they want changed, and not just changed. They literally write the legislation
them. I know.
They provide all the, quote, scientific backup to kind of enforce why they should do that. But they never hear the other side. So this is really why I really started on this path and trying to build a movement, both grassroots to create awareness, but also a movement within Washington to deal with the 2,000 people who make the decisions in the White House, the agencies, and Congress, and educate them and I think help them understand that they're not acting in their best interest ultimately, nor in the best interest of their constituents.
Yes.
Because, like you said, I mean, the fact that no one, I mean, Tim Ryan talked about it a little bit when he was running for president, but no one has talked about how Medicare for All will be a disaster unless we fix the reason why we're so overburdened with chronic disease.
We absolutely should
have health as a human right.
Yes.
But the fact that we aren't even talking about why people are using Medicare, why it's so expensive, why people are sick, is just, to me, criminal. We need to face the fact of why we're sick and why our healthcare system is so crippled. And we're seeing that now with COVID-19. We already had a healthcare system overwhelmed by chronic disease. And now it cannot take on the extra burden of dealing with this viral illness. And if we unburden people from these diseases, which are almost entirely preventable and often very curable through food, we literally could dramatically reduce our healthcare expenditures as a nation. We could improve the quality of health, improve people's happiness, and not actually need to bankrupt the nation to pay for healthcare.
Yes, 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 exactly. Well, that is really important. Really important, So how about the AMA?
Well, I think there's an
increasing... Where are they on then?
I think there's an increasing awareness that, you know, that this is an issue. You know, Cleveland Clinic, we have a food as medicine program there. There are many institutes like Tulane that have culinary medicine. There's a starting awareness of how important this is. But the truth is that many of the professional associations are funded by the food industry and the ag industry. So you know, one of the reasons we're in this mess is not just because of lobbying. There's a very concerted and I think deliberate strategy by food and ag to do a number of things. One, to massively advocate and lobby in Congress. We just covered that.
Right.
To co-opt science. And the way they do this is they spend 12 times what the government spends on nutrition, quote, nutrition research, producing studies that are so ridiculous, like candy is a great way for kids to lose weight, or that soda plays no role in obesity. And so they pollute the science, they confuse consumers, they create doubt, which is exactly what the tobacco industry did.
Yes, exactly, and the oil industry, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they lobby, they corrupt science, then they infiltrate public health groups and professional associations like the American Heart Association, the Academy of Nutrition Dietetics, the American Diabetes Association, and they fund those groups with millions and millions of dollars. And so they're conflicted. And then they fund even public health groups like Feeding America, which is a hunger group, where most of the people on the board and most of the funding comes from the food industry, which is why those groups oppose any modification of the SNAP or food program to improve nutrition quality, which is so unfortunate, because we can implement nutrition guidelines as part of food stamps. We do that with food, school lunches. We do that with the Women
and
Children Feeding Program, but they oppose that. And then they infiltrate the social advocacy groups like the Hispanic Federation, the NAACP, and fund them with millions of dollars that actually make them allies and allow them to oppose things like soda taxes. So the very populations, the minorities who are more genetically susceptible and are more targeted by the food industry, they're opposing things that will help them because of the funding.
So
you've got lobbying, you've got nutrition co-opting, you've got professional science co-opt, you've got social advocacy groups co-opted, and then they create front groups. So just four companies spent $500 million over 4 years on front groups to confuse the public. For example, a group called Climate Smart Agriculture. Now, Bob, you would probably join that group because it sounds so great. But actually, it's a ruse for fertilizer companies to promote the increased use of fertilizer through what they call sustainable intensification. So they hijack the language, or they create the American Council on Science and Health, which purports that GMO, smoking, pesticides, trans fat, high fructose corn syrup are all fine for us. And they are funded by Monsanto and Pepsi and Coca-Cola and Big Ag. That group alone spent $30 million to defeat the labeling law for GMO in California.
Yes.
And they won. Right.
So
this is the kind of stuff that's going on across all these sectors that leads to such confusion and doubt when there really is no doubt about this.
No, there is no doubt about it. So listen, so then what about this? Let me ask you this. What about... How could it be? I mean, this is all due to money, right? They make money. They think they make more money this way. But how could it be that they could make more money another way?
Yeah.
You know, like I meet sometimes in Europe with the Norwegian group where they bring oil people together, because Shell and BP have a little tiny trickle of half greenwashing, half enlightenment. And I always tell them, why aren't you guys looking at the data and then deciding to, well, you have big capital, put the capital into renewables now and be the kings of the ongoing energy industry?
Yeah.
Why are you insisting on spending $100 billion every year finding more oil that you can never burn?
Yeah.
Why? Yeah. What is the reason you're stuck in this treadmill of self-destruction? When you could, you know, you like being wealthy, you like making money, you could make more money longer term without end on harnessing the sun and the wind and the earth and the ocean. Yeah. And they go, well, you're right, Bob, but that's all we know how to do.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. You know, I actually had a chance to meet with somebody who ran the Sovereign Wealth Fund for Abu Dhabi, one of the wealthiest nations in the world.
Yes.
And he said, they have, you know, 100, 200 years of oil left. He said, but they're actually investing heavily in renewables, and they use solar to run their desalination plants in Abu Dhabi. And I asked him why, and he said, it's much cheaper for us than the oil. So I think this is going to happen. And I think you know, people are stuck in a certain paradigm. People have certain business models, you know, and if you make 8-track tapes, you know, you went out of business. If you made horse and buggies, you went out of business unless you adapted. And I think there are companies that are adapting and understanding the benefit and the economics of this and the benefit to them. The problem is the economic system is set up to socialize costs and privatize profits. So meaning the consumer, the taxpayer, the government paying the bill.
To cap them to suicide, committing to pay for their own suicide.
So right now, you know, for example, if we created a method for paying for carbon sequestration, carbon capture.
Regenerative agriculture,
Yeah, regenerative agriculture. We would actually incentivize a different form of agriculture. And there are companies now that are doing that. So, for example, Danone and General Mills have a big regenerative agriculture programs, and they believe that it's in their best interest to protect their supply chain, because they understand that the way we're growing food now with our industrial agricultural methods, it's threatening our ability to grow food in the future.
I know,
because it's going to be destroying the soil that we need to grow the food. So they get that.
Dust Bowl by 2030.
That's
Dust
right.
Bowl. Dust
I mean, we are projected John to run Steinbeck. Out of soil within 60 harvests, according to the UN. That means no soil, no humans. I mean, forget about climate change. That's the biggest crisis.
And they're selling this Monsanto. They're bribing governors in India to turn the Indian farmers into this, and the Indian farmers are committing suicide.
Well, even in America, suicide is on the rise. Bankruptcies are on the rise. The average farmer loses money. So what they're finding now is that actually it's in their best interest, and they're funding farmers. These big food companies are funding farmers. Good. To learn how to do regenerative agriculture and to convert their farms, because it takes about 3 years to convert over and get the economics right. But then those farms make far more money than the regular conventional farms. So this is going to be an economic argument.
And they produce more food per acre than that stupid monoculture.
That's right. Gabe Brown is a regenerative farmer I talk about in my book, Food Fix, who was a traditional North Dakota farmer, had 5,000 acres, and was growing industrial food. And his farm was devastated by hail and weather and so forth. And he was about to go bankrupt, and he decided to try something different and has actually created a regenerative farm where he produces more food, better quality food, in a regenerative way that uses less resources, less water, no chemical inputs, no fertilizer, and makes 20 times the amount of money as his neighbor, all while actually increasing the soil. He's built 29 inches of soil, which holds per 1% organic matter can hold 27,000 gallons of water, which makes him drought and flood resistant.
That's so fabulous.
And he's increased the biodiversity in his farm. Yeah. And it's all a win-win-win-win for everybody, and it's a doable thing. So I think the economics are going to be driving this. I think these companies are starting to think about this. I think, you know, consumers are driving change in the marketplace. So while we may feel powerless, our choices matter. Burger King released an ad that was sort of goofy, but it showed a big Whopper going moldy in time-lapse photography over 34 days, and the caption was at the end of the commercial, was the beauty of no artificial preservatives. And so that's not to say a Big Whopper is healthy, but it's showing that the food companies are responding to the market. Kellogg's decided they were going to announce to get, they were going to have glyphosate out of their cereals by 2025. Glyphosate is a weed killer. It's incredibly toxic to harmful to humans.
What's with the 2025? What is that?
Well, they decided they're going to...
What's wrong with 2021?
I agree, but it takes, to change over the farms. I mean, they got to change over all the agriculture. So right now, there's more glyphosate or weed killer in your Cheerios than there is vitamin D and vitamin B12, which are added to the cereal as fortification. If you put it on the label, it would be more in the ingredient list.
Oh, no. When I was little, although I think not at that time, I would only eat Cheerios.
Oh, no.
I wouldn't eat Rice Krispies. Well, I wouldn't eat Corn Flakes.
Back then, they didn't put glyphosate on it, so you're fine.
I know. And you know why? I found out, Vincey, when I was with the Tibetan monk, Tibetans eat zampa, roasted barley flour.
Zampa, yes.
It tastes exactly like all those old Cheerios tasted.
Oh.
And I wouldn't eat any other cereal. To me, it's a big proof of former life.
Yeah.
my mother and father were really freaked out. I would not touch my brothers.
So you were a Tibetan monk in your last life, and all you ate was roasted barley for breakfast.
That's right.
Oh, I have to tell you.
Have you ever had zampa?
I have zampa. Yeah, actually, I have to tell you a quick story.
With salty buttered tea, yes. You moisten it with that. So it's a little warm, and it has a little salt. And it has
dree cheese, which is a female yak.
Yeah, right.
So I actually was with the abbot of Menri, who's the 33rd abbot of the Bun tradition, a few years ago before he died. And he really was diabetic, was not super healthy.
I know. Because they eat junk food as refugees when they first come out.
Well, he
takes
the
time to learn it.
He didn't,
no, that's what they were given that as
yes,
as,
of course. So we were sitting. He made me eat every meal with him, and I was sitting with him,
and he was eating
sampa, and I said, "This is not good for you because it's just grain, and you're diabetic." He's like, "No, this is our traditional food." I said, "Yeah, maybe if you were herding yaks at 17,000 feet, you could eat this, but you're sitting on a meditation cushion all day. And it's not the best thing." He's like, no, it's fine. I said, okay, let's do an experiment. Let's check your blood sugar after you eat it. And let's check mine. And let's check the other monk who was healthy.
All right.
And
you did that?
And we did that. And his blood sugar went through the roof. And he was like, oh, my. And he saw that, this was a problem. And then he was willing to change his diet. And we got his diet changed. We had got him lose 35 pounds.
Oh, that's awesome.
He got
awesome.
Really healthy, and it was really awesome. He was just my best patient ever.
Well, you know, he and I made a special pact agreement because, Bun is Buddhism.
Yes.
Outside of Tibet, universally. Nobody questions it, and they basically teach Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
But they just have a different Buddha.
Yeah.
Who lived in Iran like 40,000 years ago, and there's no record, there's no text, The texts are all from the Indian guy. So in Tibet, they didn't accept the Indian guy from some political reason of 1,800 years ago. And then the Buddhists in Tibet consider them different, right? So the Dalai Lama treats them as Buddhists in the exile. But we met in an airplane right next to each other after having known each other 20 years before when I was a monk.
I mean, just randomly met each other.
Random, sitting right there. And he sat down, seat right next to me. And a shuttle flight from New York to Washington, Dulles.
Uh-huh.
And we said, we have to cure this because you're Buddhists. Proudly yourselves, you're happy to be Buddhists. But not in Tibet. When you go back, then you'll still be this Buddhist versus Bun versus Buddhist. And I said, so let's do this. Let's make a deal. You accept the Shakyamuni, and they'll accept your Shenrab in Iran. And they'll say, well, we don't know what happened 40,000 years ago, so we can't say it wasn't there. And then you can say, well, we don't know. He made another emanation in India, so accept that. And he shook on it. He stamped it. It's ready to go. And I told Dalai Lama about it. He said, yeah, that's why I did that a long time ago, said Dalai Lama.
Well, they were good friends.
But the thing is that how to get it back into demand. Anyway, I'm sorry, but I like that guy. But it's the coming back to the food deserts. I'm sorry, I digress.
No, it's good. It's a good story.
But anyway, the food deserts.
But you know, the Tibetan monks.
Couldn't we interest people like Walmart, Safeway, or any of those food things that still exist that Walmart hasn't destroyed, and get them to realize that they can't really make the big boxes anymore? Malls are kind of done for, actually, for other reasons. And they could make a lot of money now instead of competing with Jack in the Box and Pizza Hut and all this, and they could put vegetable stores with their massive,
That's actually true. Deserts. Yes,
Younger generation of the Walton and Robson families.
They do. They care about this. In fact,
they're upset about it because they feel nervous about it. I know.
No, they're very focused on this. In fact, you know, Walmart is the biggest seller of organic produce.
I know.
The Walton family and Walmart are very focused on providing more whole foods and actually focusing on health. And we've been talking to them and working with them. And it's very exciting.
Why can't they make smaller stores in those areas? If there has to be money there if all those junk food businesses are opening there like mad. And they go in there for that money, then they can make money.
Yeah. I mean, there are all kinds of business models that could work. And I think this is going to require innovation in business. It's going to require policy change. It's going to require consumer behavior change. And, the book I write is called Food Apocalypse. It's called Food Fix. So it's about the solutions, not just the problems.
And I want to say that I like that. I myself, you're better than me because I'm too much on the fierce compassion side. And it's like I get very impatient with these things.
Yeah.
But I notice that you always look for, well, there was a good intention in food stamps. Well, there was a good intention in this. Actually, I once gave a talk at a Pepsi conference. That was the last one I was invited to. Not for that reason. But I gave a talk, which I got a good honorarium, so I went, But I gave a talk saying about how they started out, Coca-Cola did anyway, with coca leaves. In the thing, which are a stimulant used in Bolivia and Peru, and they don't refine that thing and snort it like movie stars, etc., but they just chew it, and it helps them with altitude, and it's a stimulant. And so all sodas were originally in a pharmacy. And, the guy in Atlanta who invented Coca-Cola, that's what he was doing in a long time ago, a guy named Pemberton, because I know one of his descendants who has no residue of royalty. But anyway, so I gave him a talk like that. I said, this business that you're doing of making people unhealthy is going to be discovered by people and you'll be in trouble. So why don't you move over back into health and make things that go back into being helping people?
Yes.
While you have the money. And they didn't mind that too much, although I was drowned out. Me and another guy were drowned out by a guy from the American Enterprise Institute who started telling them that they were going to be longevity drugs that were coming up from the big pharma, and they'd all be living to 150 and playing golf.
Eating whatever they want, right.
Exactly. No, that's not happening. They had been looking alert from my talk and another guy. And they'd all slump back in their chair But that's why they didn't invite me back. They didn't invite me back because I told a Coke joke in the evening.
Oh, no.
The cabaret. But I won't tell that here. I won't tell another time.
Here's where my belief in whether it's true or not. I don't believe there is a lot of evil intent out there. I mean, there are bad people and there are serial killers and there was Hitler and all that.
Yeah, but there are no bad people.
For the most part, these people want good things for them, for their families or communities.
Yeah.
They're locked in a business model that's antiquated, that's outdated, and needs to be updated. And they are trying to figure out how to do this. And I sort of was the anti-food industry for a long time. And then I sort of began meeting and talking to the leaders in the industry, presidents, CEOs, top executives, and really having deeper conversations. And they're really curious and they're interested. Like the CEO of Nestle is very focused on this. You've got these big companies. Now you could say, well, it's greenwashing and maybe it's true, but I do believe they're trying to actually innovate and trying to figure it out. It's just hard to move a super tanker and change the entire model for them because, you know, you have to figure out how to survive.
And I think,
you know, that's a challenge. And I think that, but they are thinking about it and they do want to be part of the solution. They also are at the same time doing things to really obstruct the whole process, but
yeah,
it's schizophrenic a little bit.
Of course.
But I think
we can't though accept the super tanker thing too much because the amount of metal in a super tank, if you put them in all kinds of small delivery boats, they could easily change course, you know. It's like the English did destroy the Spanish Armada, you know. They totally did.
Yeah.
They were small boats, you know. And the Greeks destroyed the Persian triremes with their little boats. So in the long run, they're not and that long run is getting shorter and shorter. And so, but what I just wanted to say was I love it that you dig in your causation to find the good intention that may be there buried under the really nasty habit.
That's right.
You know, as my old Mongolian used to say, there are no bad people. There's just bad things that good people do.
Yeah.
And you have to get in to find the good part in there, which everybody has, you know.
Yeah. I mean, there's a Buddhist principle that I often think about called upaya, which is translated. I don't know what the right translation salvific means, which doesn't really make any sense to most people.
They translate that skillful means, which is wrong.
Yeah.
But means is not wrong. It doesn't mean it means means or method. But you know what it really means is art.
Yeah. It's sort of the art of how to communicate with people to help them understand. Whether you're a Buddhist and you're teaching a child or a monk or a factory worker or a PhD, you're going to be speaking differently to them about what you're talking about.
Yeah,
and I think we have to learn how to have that art of communication so that, you know, I can and you can have conversations with people who disagree with us, who have different worldviews, who have different philosophies, and find the commonality in who we are and what we're experiencing. Yeah. And I think, you know, this moment right now, you know, while it's really tough and there's a lot of people suffering from the challenges around this virus, this COVID-19 virus, it's also a unique moment where all of a sudden we're in this common shared humanity and we're all having the same human experience together of this threat.
It's
not respecting ideological boundaries, religious beliefs, dietary philosophies, nothing. And so we're had this moment where like, wow, we're all human first.
And people
say to me, how can you talk to this one? And how can you speak to, you know, this Republican or that Democrat?
I'm
like, listen, we're all human first. And I have compassion for all humans. And I think everybody is a human being and a human soul first. And then whatever their beliefs are, is the conditioning that they've had, their experiences, whatever.
That's right.
It may be right, it may be wrong, but I don't pay attention to that. And I try to actually figure out how do I reach that human being in there who wants the goodness for humanity, who wants goodness for them and their families and their children and their children's children. And I think if we can appeal to that, I do think we will see change.
Yes, well, that's the thing, you know, like, the reason you're able to do that, from a Buddhist point of view, the person who's able to do that is the person who's willing to be aware that they themselves have a negative side in themselves. You know, in other words, here you're teaching food fix and you probably are craving, a chocolate eclair after dinner.
Well, actually, I almost broke down the night because my wife, you know, we've been, you know, stuck here and somehow somebody was talking about chocolate chip cookies and I got in my head that I wanted to make chocolate chip cookies.
Exactly.
But
wait a minute. Let me ask you this question. What about stevia? What is the biology of stevia?
Good question.
Seriously.
The biology of artificial sweeteners is bad.
No.
But stevia may be a little bit better. I think there is some data that it may actually not cause some of the harmful effects of the traditional artificial sweeteners. However, I would caution you because most of the stevia we're consuming is industrial stevia, and it's made, it's either Truvia or Purevia, and those sound like wonderful names.
They're made
by Coca-Cola and Cargill and Pepsi.
Oh no.
So they're industrialized versions of stevia, which are extracting the alkaloids, which taste a little bit bitter. So the alkaloids are the things in plants which may have beneficial effects. So we may be taking out the beneficial components and extracting it. But again, you know, if you really have a sweet tooth, it's going to stimulate the sweet receptors, and then it's going to make you want more and more and more. So
it's addictive.
Yes. So
it's less diabeticizing than
yes, I think so. Sugar. I think so. But again, it's just like it's going to make you eat more, crave more, probably eat more foods.
So
I'd be careful. Yes, enjoy it, but yeah.
I don't do Truvia. I try to find whole stevia. But I was always thinking about chocolate with stevia instead of corn syrup, you know.
A little chocolate's okay. Dark chocolate, a little bit, it's fine.
So my granddaughter informed me that dark chocolate will not cut it.
No, you need the milk chocolate.
Oh, yes. She let me know. Grandpa. No.
But you know, here's the thing.
No.
Just in terms of our kids, because, you know, this is a large part of what I write about in the book, is how our kids have been hijacked in their taste buds
and how
harmed they are. You know, 2 out of 10 kids are obese. Yes. 4 out of 10 kids are overweight. So many kids have ADD and behavioral issues. It's really tragic.
But what
we've done in this country is to corrupt our children very early on with these foods that makes them crave them. And when you go to countries like Japan, what do they eat for breakfast? They eat raw fish and seaweed, right? Kids, there's no special kids' foods or Lunchables or kids' menus. It's just like if a little kid in Japan is eating raw fish and seaweed, in this country, we're giving them junk, they're going to want junk. So I don't think it's an inherent property of children want crap. It's something we've taught them to do.
Okay, you're stiffening my grandpa backbone. Okay.
Well, you can make healthier treats that are not so bad, that are high fiber, high protein, good fats, less starch and sugar. I've got lots of them in my cookbook, Food, What the Heck Should I Cook?
I have that book.
If people are home and they're wondering what to cook and they're just trying to make good food, try it out. Food, What the Heck Should I Cook?
That's totally great. So you mean Truvia might have aspartame in it, you mean?
No, it doesn't, but it's Reboside A. So it basically extracts the...
Yeah, they never just let the natural thing happen.
No,
right?
it's all a industrial byproduct of stevia, may have other unintended consequences.
Do you know the aspartame story? Do you know the story?
I do. Donald Rumsfeld.
Yes.
The guy who brought us the Iraq War.
Reagan, of course, brought the lawyers of that company into the FDA.
Mm-hmm.
And Carter had banned it, right? Mm-hmm. You know that best.
Yeah.
You really know. You've really been down the rabbit hole. That's really good.
I know all about it.
So how can I help?
How can I help? I think you are helping. I mean, you are communicating, you're sharing about this, you're part of the climate initiative from Al Gore, you're spreading the word, and I think, you know, your fierceness, your sort of sword of wisdom is cutting through all this nonsense.
A little bit, but I'm getting more moderate about it all. But the thing is that I feel, you know, it's like the thing about the green nukes. I do feel that the activists tend to think it's all going to happen when we go out in the street. You know, we're going to protest and we're going to do this and they're all bad and they're terrible.
No.
And, you know, I actually was surprised. I went down to Occupy Wall Street and I gave a talk there and we got them to meditate on compassion for the people above in the buildings who were freaking out because they were there in the occupying that square, you know, that they are just as troubled as the poor people.
Yeah.
You know, they're starved in another way. You know, they have money, but they can't eat the money, you know, and then they eat bad food and they get cancer and die young themselves and they overindulge, you know, mm-hmm. and, So I, and they were liking it. They were doing their thing, you know. They liked it. And I loved the sign one of them had. They had a sign that they would go around showing to the police who were standing around. Yeah. And they would say, you guys are one layoff away from being on this side.
Yes, I know. It's crazy.
So, I'm saying, like, the we have to go to the leadership as well to get them to be on their better side, is what I'm trying to say.
We do, and I think that's the goal, is to, and I've sort of been interested to see how in Washington, in my travels there's such an openness on both sides of the aisle to addressing this. You know, I met with Republican leaders, Democrat yes. leaders, and once they begin to understand this,
there are a few bad apples.
Yeah, there may be, but you know, I think.
And in other words, what I used to say, since Reagan, I've been getting annoying people, but I like to say when some Republicans come up who manage to sit through one of my Buddhist ethics talks, they come up and they say, well, what about Republicans? And then I say, we need Republicans. I say those radical who want to take away all Social Security, destroy the New Deal, like take everything away from everybody and blah, 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 you know, right, Ayn Rand, you know, sort of thing. They're not real Republicans. They're some kind of radical sort of, you know, neo-corrupt thing, you know.
Yeah.
And they're trapped themselves in the machine of that because they don't, you know, I have a thing I like to say. Imagine you had 35 billion right now. Maybe you could have fun with the first half a billion for the rest of your life. But the other 34 and a half are like a burden.
Yeah.
You know, where is it invested? Are they cheating me? How many people am I hiring?
Well, that's why there's a giving pledge. There's something called the giving pledge, and a lot of these billionaires
I know,
are actually
joining that. Waiting until they die.
No. They're giving it during their lifetime. People like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, there's a whole group. It's called the giving pledge.
I know, but I thought they're waiting until they die.
I don't think so.
Half of what's left.
I don't exactly know how it works, but I think
I know they give small amounts. They have foundations and they give out 5% in the foundation. You have to give out 5% a year. I know they do that. But the big thing of giving half of my billions, I believe, is when you die.
Hmm.
And what I want to say is when they die, they're going to be climate refugees. Their children will be diabetic. They'll be completely in a mess. So why don't they peel off a couple billion and give them to Food Fix Association.
Please, yes. The Food Fix campaign, yes.
And Gore, I told Al Gore, why don't you ask for a billion and train everybody, not just 30,000, 40,000 people.
Yes, absolutely.
And he said, oh, that's great. Yeah, good idea. He says, and they all said, that's a good idea.
You got to think big.
And then the staff people, I urged them, I begged them, I said, please go to the MacArthur Foundation in the cycle of the $100 million grant. And apply for that for Climate Reality Project and Food Fix. Apply for that,
yes,
please.
Yes, yes. Well, we are working with the Rockefeller Foundation, other groups, and you know, we are in raising money now to drive this campaign, which will drive policy to fix the system. And you know, we have a website, foodfix.org, where you can learn more about it. And we also have a Food Fix.
If you had a few billion, they need to go to these people and give them the Greta Thunberg. Please give to these other people. They can do it. I think they maybe don't want to because they feel if they ask for a few billion from the giving pledge people, then those people would expect them to put in a few hundred million, and maybe they don't feel like that. But they can easily do that.
Yes, it's true. It's just that the people, the right information is not being communicated in a coherent way to help them understand the path.
In a loving way. And there's no bad. Nothing is bad. A loving way. But rigorous. No greenwashing.
Yes.
But then, or good greenwashing. Actually, if Walmart made 500 small retail vegetable stores.
Yeah, they could. They could.
In the inner cities of the United States. That would be a bigger thing than a $3 billion Medicaid for all. That would do more for the health of the people.
I agree.
Right?
So powerful.
And they would make money.
Yeah, there are so many ways to make this happen. It just requires, you know, this kind of critical mass of awareness and movement. And I think that's
actually what it requires is a functional medicine man seeing the deeper causation and a more holistic vision, and realizing that there's more benefit and more profit in doing good.
That's right. That's right. I think at the end of the day, it's an economic argument. If you don't get motivated by the need to save humanity, at least save our economy and our planet. I think that's a good thing.
That's a start. That's a real good start. Like, imagine, you know, I was at a benefit where a bunch of billionaires were there, and they were going to help scholarships for underprivileged children. And they raised $14-15 million in an evening.
Wow.
Some fairly not so good food. and some of it wasn't bad, you know. And I kept thinking, I mean, I gave something myself, but I kept thinking, a small amount, but I kept thinking, when these kids graduate high school and these scholarships will kick in for them after they've done extremely well, they're going to be leaving Oakland and East Palo Alto, and they're going to be moving to Nevada.
Yeah.
Their jobs are going to be waiting for them in Colorado, you know, east of the Rockies, the way it's going in California, according to the Al Gore thing. It's that drought that's in Guatemala and Honduras now, worst drought on the planet, is moving right up the Pacific coast all the way to British Columbia.
Yeah, well, we saw it before. It's going to get worse. It's true. Well, we got to work to do, Professor.
10% for 10 years, and it'll be more calm.
Well, that's what the
beer is. Starting in 2021.
We can do it. I mean, it's doable.
We just did it for 2 months.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, the UN said that if we took of using regenerative agriculture, which is a way to capture carbon in the soil, it's the most efficient way to do it.
Yes.
If we took 2 million of the 5 million hectares of degraded land around the world that's been destroyed through industrial agriculture and overgrazing, if we convert it to regenerative agriculture, we could stop climate change for 20 years. And it would only cost $300 billion, which sounds like a lot.
But it's less
than the amount that Medicare spends just on diabetes every year. Just Medicare and diabetes.
I know, so, because they're cutting off toes.
Yeah.
They cut them off.
It's pretty screwed up. We pay for a toe amputation or a kidney dialysis, but we won't pay for a nutrition consult. You go figure.
I know. Well, no, you have figured. Listen, I'm sorry. I don't mean to intrude.
No.
It's your time here, and I'm so grateful, and I want to talk to more doctors, and I want you to have to increase this platform that you're doing this awesome job. Actually, I was going to ask you, the thing you gave me with key messages, etc.
Yes.
I know that's like a summary of the book. You know?
Yes. People give me the book, go to Food Fix, but we covered a lot of it.
It's like an executive summary, but I know one billionaire who I would like to send it to, who I also have sent the book already as an ebook.
Oh, thank you.
But I don't expect that person necessarily to read it, the whole book.
Yes.
Can I send this, or is this?
Of course, no. You can send whatever you want.
Oh, okay. I'm going to also send it. Actually, can you send it to me? Oh, I have it electronically. Yes, I'm going to send it in a message, because I might read the summary, you know, but then move on to the book, or might have looked at some of the book.
I can send you also in a different summary that might help too.
Oh yeah, that would be.
I'll send you a few things to share.
Yeah, I like to send you a few people. I really would, because they do want to do things, and they are doing things.
I know. People just don't know what to do.
Here's the thing, you see, like I said about Buddhism. You see, what Buddha did, you see, he didn't, make a religion out of it, some people do. And then some of them use it to just frighten people more, like the other religions tend to do, to aggrandize themselves. You know, you need us or you won't survive. But he didn't say that. What he really said is, everyone can know what to do.
Yeah.
Really solidly. And they can really do it. And everyone knowing that is a huge thing to do.
Yeah, we do have the power. We have the collective power. We have the ability. 100%.
When we really know, if we really come to learn, in 50 years, what I learned is there's no such thing as nothing.
No.
There's no nothing.
Yeah.
So therefore, I have to commit to everything.
It's true.
And I restrain myself when I find myself not listening to my wife.
Ah, you have to listen to their wife always.
Because they're more aware of everything than we guys are.
It's so true.
They're less tunnel vision, you know. They tend to be. Listen, Mark Hyman. Well, it's not good because it isn't enough.
It is enough. Because, there's more.
Because you really have done it, in my opinion. Listen, are you going to make an inconvenient food?
I've been trying to actually get a documentary going. We've been having conversations. I need to find the right person. No, I agree.
That movie done with love for the food people, even. Mm.
Yeah, I agree.
And let them come and say something.
Yes.
As a greenwash. Send their greenwashers out to talk to you. But I think that's a really urge. So I can help. I'm going to talk to people.
Thank you. I'm going to count you as part of the food fix campaign.
I want to be part of it. If there's anything I can sign up for, I will do that.
Thank you.
I really will. We do more podcasts in the future. Really, it's a really great what you've done. And I really want an association of doctors to be calling out the Monsantos and so forth as a corporate thing, not as individuals, corporate thing. Calling them out as a public health matter.
Mm. Well, really, thank you so much for having me on your podcast, Professor. Okay. It's been such an honor. I'm so grateful you see the whole connection.
Yes, and I look forward to you doing things with Menla, you know.
But yes.
You know, Menla means medicine Buddha. You know that.
Yes, I do.
In Tibetan, you know.
Yes.
It does mean medicine Buddha.
So more work together. We're on this path.
All right. Great.
The Bob Thurman Podcast is published by Tibet House US, Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons, no derivatives, non-commercial license. Please feel free to share on your favorite social media platforms. Hope you are staying happy, healthy, and safe during the quarantine. Tashi Dalek, and thanks for tuning in.